Welcome to the Nail Your Nutrition podcast, a podcast focused on training for endurance activity. I'm Sarah, a registered dietitian and toddler mom in the Washington, D.C. area. I write the blog Bucket List Tummy and focus most of my work on running and endurance athletes, as well as merging the principles of sports nutrition with the principles of intuitive eating.
And I'm Marita, a sports dietitian and fellow toddler mom in Pensacola, Florida. I work with endurance athletes at my private practice, Eat to Compete. My goal is to help athletes learn to fuel their training with intuitive eating. We are two sports dietitians and moms here to break down the nutrition science to make training more fun and approachable for you. Whether you're a novice athlete, a weekend warrior, a mom trying to fit in a consistent exercise schedule, or a top finisher at big races, we want to help you understand the importance of fueling well. We're so glad to have you here and would appreciate you spreading the word or sharing this episode or podcast with a friend, family member, training partner, coworker, or anyone you would think would enjoy it. If you have a minute, please leave us a review wherever you subscribe to your podcast, as that really helps the show. Now let's get to today's episode. Hey friends, today we're talking with Georgie Buckley, an Australian dietitian and PhD candidate, about her research on disordered eating in current and former athletes. Georgie is a former elite level track and field distance runner, so her research is informed by her experience. Her research first looked at the gaps in the eating disorder literature and just focused on male athletes, but now it has expanded to challenging sport culture and incorporating feminist theory, especially regarding how women and girls' bodies in sport are objectified and commented on. During this episode, we discussed how detrimental commenting on girls and women's bodies in sport can be long-term for those women, her experience as an elite-level track and field athlete, what exactly disordered eating is, how current and former athletes can heal from disordered eating, and how we can change this obsessiveness with appearance and thinness in sport, especially for endurance events. Before we dive in, I just wanted to remind you about our monthly raffle we have for those who leave us a review. We so appreciate you taking the time to type up a short review for the podcast and want to say thank you. So each month we choose one random review, and that reviewer can have a free 30-minute call with either Sarah or myself to talk all things nutrition. If you want to support the podcast even more, we started a Patreon account with different levels of Patreon support to choose from, with tons of freebies, discount codes, and more. The lower tier is just $3 a month, less than your latte order. Sarah and I pour so much into this podcast and want to continue to provide you guys with the best. Head to patreon.com/nailyournutrition or check out the show notes to support us. The link is right there, making it really easy for you guys. Thank you so much for supporting us. Okay, let's go ahead and dive in and chat with Georgie. We hope you guys enjoy this episode, and if you have any comments, let us know. All right, Georgie, we're so happy to have you on, and we can't wait to dive into today. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, both academic, as a researcher, as a practitioner, since you are a dietitian, and your athletic background?
Sure. So I was a very serious junior athlete, and I won multiple national level championships all throughout high school. And I think that really got me interested in sort of the sports health field. And I always knew I wanted to work in health, and I thought it was going to be medicine, and sort of pursued that way of thinking. And then eventually got to it, and nutrition started to click in place. And I think I'll touch on this a little bit as well around why I've become interested in disordered eating, that I just had this like pull to dietetics. And I couldn't really put my finger on it. I was just really interested, which I think is a really common story amongst dietitians. And when I finally got into it, I realized like eating disorders was cool, and started to pursue that area a lot more, and everything kind of fell into place a bit. So I've been practicing as a dietitian the last nearly 3 years. And I started my PhD when I finished my dietetics degree as well. So it's been absolutely jam-packed since then. And I'm set to finish my PhD sometime next year. So doing a PhD in a pandemic is interesting at the moment. Yeah, and so both of my areas, I guess, in dietetics and in my research really combine at the moment.
That's fascinating. And we're going to talk a lot more about your research because I think it's very pertinent to the audience that we have. And I myself am also interested in hearing more. First, I want to dive a little into your athletic background. So you mentioned you were a junior athlete. So how did you get into running? And I know we talked a little off the cuffs before we started recording, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about how sports work differently in Australia for college athletes?
Yeah. So I started running when I was 10 years old, and cross country and track and field are kind of the sports that every primary school, which yeah, like sort of that 10 to 12 year old age, everyone does it. And I think I had that sort of natural ability where, you know, how kids can just kind of rock up at a race and just absolutely smash it. And I was one of those kids that would sort of find themselves winning races and not training. And that was when I got, I guess, suggested to start training with a squad. And that's when things got a little bit more serious. And I was training sort of 4 to 6 times a week. And it's kind of wild thinking back on that as, you know, doing that kind of running as a 10, 11, 12 year old. And I just absolutely loved it. Like running became my whole life. And I looked up to the elite athletes so much and sort of went through that all through high school with various little challenges along the way, I guess, with that, you know, coming into puberty is such a hard time for a female athlete with the messages that you get told all around you. And I sort of survived that and won a few national championships in my last few years of high school. And I got injured in my final year of high school. And I remember just thinking, huh, what would it be like to stop? And I took a bit of a break from running, and I was still doing lots of jogging, but I wasn't training. And I had a few years break. So I went into university because we don't really have a collegiate program at all. You basically, in Australia, you can be a top level junior athlete, and you could get recruited to an American college and pursue college athletics that way, or you just basically go into open age athletics or track and field in Australia, you know, as soon as you're 18. So there's a really big gap there, and we lose so many athletes in Australia because of that if they don't go to college in America. So I had maybe 3 or 4 years off when I finished high school and had lots of fun at university. And we have this competition, which is laughable compared to NCAA athletics. It's called University Games. And it is the most relaxed competition you could possibly have. There's a social program every night, and you dress up in costume. And I thought, oh, I'll just do this. And I turned up at this competition and, you know, did a 400 and an 800. I was like, ooh, I haven't really lost too much fitness here. And I kind of got back into athletics again for another season or two. And I made an open national final, where I came 6th in Australia, and they took the first 4 women to the World Relay Championships. And yeah, so kind of I was close to that elite level, but not quite. You know, I wasn't a pro runner, and you know, I never made any open international teams or anything like that. But I guess I trained alongside all of these women that did, so I really have a good handle on what it's like to really, I guess, step it up to that level and what that training is like, because I was doing it just without that elite status. So, yeah, lots of my best friends that I've grown up with have gone on to become Olympians or, you know, Australian record holders, all different kinds of things. And I've really been amongst that distance running culture and that distance running community basically my whole life. And I think that really fuels so much of what I do now in my profession.
What was your event that you competed in, or that was your favorite to compete in?
I loved 800s and 1500s when I was a high school athlete. And then I found that my body changed and became stronger. And I started to gear towards more of 800 became my main one. And then I sort of dabbled a little bit in 400s, but didn't quite have the speed.
You mentioned some changes at puberty and how you dealt with that. Like, are you meaning like from a coach, or can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. So I guess the message for me as I was getting to, 12, 13 years old, people started to talk about these anticipated body changes that I would go through. And, there was the formalized way of being told what they'd go through school, and you'd have your sex ed and stuff, and, people saying body changes are normal, you're going to gain weight and you'll gain body fat, and that's a great thing. And then there was the track and field side of it, where it was the indirect, informal way of learning, which is the one that I really latched onto. And the language around that was often coaches or other athletes like talking about girls going through puberty as a really unfavorable thing. And
like a negative thing rather than a normal thing.
Yes, absolutely. And it was this almost like belief that was just ingrained amongst us, was as soon as you hit puberty, you'll run badly for 2 to 3 years. And if you make it out of that, you'll be fine. And because of that, I just believed that wholeheartedly. I had no other sort of language to latch on to. And I remember being 12 years old, being like, this puberty thing sounds awful. And I just thought it would ruin this passion that I had with running, and it would mean that I wouldn't like it anymore, and people wouldn't see me as a runner anymore. And so I became so fearful of puberty and going through these changes, because the language around them was that you would no longer be a runner. You wouldn't be a successful runner. You'd become this thing people referred to as a woman. And I just remember being so fearful of the W word. I just thought, if I can just stay a girl forever, my running will be better. And if I can keep my body tiny, like, that is what I need to do. And I think that sets such a platform, right, for the way that you relate to your body, and then what kind of eating behaviors come from that. And it's just, looking back on it is so awful. Like, what a time of celebration, that time is, how awesome it is, like how grateful we need to be of our bodies, and then to be so fearful of that happening is horrible.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's just because I'm a parent now, but I it comes to me, like, I'm thinking, did you share these sentiments with your parents, or did you just keep that, amongst your teammates or your coaches?
Yeah, or were the girls on the team talking similarly, having those fears?
Yeah, so this is actually something, so I'm 28 this year, and this is actually only something I've started to talk about with these girls that I grew up with only now. And I had this conversation with our Australian 800-meter record holder, Katrina Bissett, who is absolutely amazing human. And we were talking about it, and it wasn't until we realized that we had exactly the same story in that way, that we were both so fearful of it. And I think when a belief is so strong, you don't question it because you just believe wholeheartedly that it's right and that there is no other way. And I think that's why we didn't talk about it, because it was just accepted as the truth with a capital T. So I just really hope that narrative is changing now in women and girls sport, but I think we still have so much to go, and it really fuels everything I do in my research and in my clinical practice as well, is dismantling those little beliefs that we just hold as truths.
Totally. And to just tag on to what you just said, I still think we have a long way to go in culture and sport, and your research is so encouraging, and I can't wait to hear you share more about that. And I know you've talked about the Mary Kane situation and that before, and what you're speaking to is actually something we talked about with your Australian colleague Fiona in one of our past episodes, just about the culture that athletes face. They have the regular culture where there's pressure to be thin and look a certain way, right? But then there's this athlete culture that they also have that imposes a lot of pressure, whether it's from coaches saying things like puberty is a negative thing and you're just going to have to get through this and suffer, and coaches saying things like that, or teammates comparing yourself to teammates, or, you know, trying to eat less than the person next to you. It just seems like a web of confusion, especially for young athletes going through these vulnerable times.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in culture broadly, like in Australia and America, athletes have this status because we see them as being these people that defy humanness. And I think with that, we think that we put them on this pedestal that they are, like, they're special and they defy what other humans can do. And we forget that they're humans foremost before they're athletes. And we often neglect these, I guess, acts or behaviors or thoughts that are inherently our most, quote, humanness kind of things, like being sad, being upset, you know, having these beliefs that we take in, that we say, well, puberty is bad and this and that. And I think we treat athletes like they're athletic robots, and they're just not. And that's how we see athletes that break, or they come out of sport a little bit disheartened, or that they've been hurt by sport. And I think the Mary Kane story was so awful to see. But for me, it was really positive to see that getting some airtime, because that is something that I haven't really seen that much, that all these people were talking about it that never would have spoken about something like that. And that's really, it's really exciting.
Right. I've said that before too. Like, if there was any positive from that, it's just that people are talking about it, it's surfaced, and hopefully, you know, we have a lot of people who are gung-ho about this and understand the detrimental consequences. So we have to start with education and obviously rallying for ourselves in these situations.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting your athletic robot is just hit home, because I've been watching The Last Dance with the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls documentary. Are you guys familiar with that one? Have you seen that?
I haven't started it, but I've seen it show up on my Netflix, right?
Yeah. And he's arguably the best athlete of all time, right? And so you see him recalling these things and getting emotional. It's almost a little bit startling. You're like, oh my goodness, like, this is literally the best athlete of all time getting, like, he's a upset person about a certain situation. Yeah. And even I thought that. I'm like, oh my gosh, wow, he really is so invested and so competitive. And it's so interesting that you said that, Georgie, because I was thinking that last night while watching it.
I think it comes as a shock at the moment that athletes can be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a wild concept in itself. Like, we all should be allowed to be vulnerable privately or publicly or however we want to do it.
Right.
And it almost feels like athletes have to be vulnerable publicly for people to take them seriously as humans. And that's wild. Like, that is wild as a concept. And I look to someone like, Katrina Bissett in Australia, who constantly speaks about her vulnerability and the way that she's overcome many different things in her mental health, and how she now channels that as the biggest power that she has in her sport. And I just, that is my hope for the future, that we can turn these vulnerabilities into something really powerful, as opposed to seeing them as weaknesses to our athletic robot states.
For sure. I think there's a lot of powerful voices emerging, like Lauren Fleshman, Tina Muir,
Alicia Montano.
Montano. Yeah, they're all coming out in that exact same vein of being more vulnerable and talking about how that sport affected them and how it's made them either a better athlete or just a better and stronger person overall. Yeah.
And I think, like, women coming together, like Lindsay Krause too, just writing the story, and Mary Kane feeling safe to go to her and having the pull that Lindsay does with the New York Times, right? Like, we need outlets like that to elevate it too. So a lot of big things happening. Georgie, I want to hear more about your research that we keep talking about. So tell us a little bit about kind of what you're studying and why that's pertinent to athletes and active individuals.
Love that. So I guess everything comes back from when I was a teenager going through this athletics kind of culture. And I remember eating disorders being spoken about relatively frequently. And sort of back in those days, it was really only ever anorexia nervosa, like low weight anorexia, that was ever spoken about. And I remember my mum printing out this little info sheet and giving it to me and being like, you know, just look out for these things. And we once had this conversation where she said to me, you know, I'm really surprised you never developed an eating disorder given like all of your personality traits and kind of align with this, you know, what this is describing. And I was like, yeah, that's weird, huh? And then, you know, I just never, ever, ever identified with having an eating disorder. And it was only until professionally I started to really delve into it and learn more about the nuances of eating disorders and what actually exists beyond anorexia nervosa and low weight anorexia as well, and started to put together what I call my jigsaw puzzles. So I started to put together my jigsaw or puzzle pieces, and all my puzzle pieces started coming together. And then I realized I had a bit of a picture, and I was like, huh, that does look like an eating disorder of what I had back when I was an adolescent. And I was very confused. I was like, no, I didn't. That wasn't me. That was, you know, these other young girls. It was very obvious. That's what an eating disorder was. And I found that I was just so disconnected with what I thought an eating disorder was with actually my embodied experience. And so now, you know, having worked in the field for quite a few years, that I can call what I had an eating disorder. And I think the fact that we can live in it for so many years and not know what's going on, but normalize what's going on, is really the main danger in sport of how these things can really snowball and get out of control. And it led me to so much of where I was really passionate with my research. So my PhD is looking specifically at disordered eating in sport rather than eating disorders. So, and I think this often needs a bit of like explanation too, like that difference, because I think most people, you know, they have an idea around what an eating disorder is, but then when you throw in disordered eating, it's like, oh, what's that one? How's that different? And it's good to, I guess, if we think about our relationship with food as a spectrum, and we've got a positive relationship with food on one side, where, you know, we've got great food access, you know, we acknowledge that it's okay for our bodies to change and that they've got their own genetic phenotype that's going to look different to someone else, and we're able to eat regularly and we're not thinking about food all the time. That's one side of the spectrum. And then we've got eating disorders on the other side of the spectrum, which is that constant preoccupation with eating and ruminating about what we're going to eat next and how we can restrict or how we can control our food, or, you know, how we're comparing, we might be comparing our bodies to other people on the start line or other people in our sporting team, or, you know, we might be counting calories, or all of these things that we aim to control. Control is really this like underlying concept here. And so on this spectrum, we've got these two ends, and then disordered eating fits just next to where eating disorders is. So it's not quite an eating disorder, but then it might also be sort of the come down from an eating disorder as well in recovery, where we're getting better. So we can move up or down the spectrum at any given time. And so eating disorders are pretty relatively well known in the research world, but disordered eating as a focus in itself has never really gotten much airtime. And in sport, my thinking was, if we can interrogate what that is, what that looks like, how that comes about in the culture, that is going to mean that we can have more powerful conversations to prevent eating disorders, but also to help people heal their relationship and nurture their relationship with food in sport, when it's going to look really different to how someone else's relationship with food looks like in just the general population.
So have you found that people who are suffering from disordered eating and are participating in sport, are they still able to participate in their sport and recover?
Yeah, so that's that's the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder. I guess I want to clarify as well, that term can sometimes get a really bad rap or negative connotation too. And I've heard, so there's a nutritionist in Australia called Kerry Beak, and she refers to it as disconnected eating. And I actually, when I'm talking about individuals, I'm talking with clients, I much prefer to use words like that rather than disordered. Sounds, it always sounds like you're doing something wrong. And there's, and really my belief and what my research is showing, exploring the culture of sport, is that we develop this disconnected eating not because we're evil or bad people, but because the culture around us is just gently pushing us in that direction, and we're just going with the flow of the river, and it leads us to this place. And there's a really good quote as well. I've been looking more and more at feminist theory, and Rachel Calogero in 2012 in a paper wrote, eating disorders are a response to women's feelings of powerlessness to control the systemic objectification of their bodies. And we see that so much in sport when women and girls' bodies are commented on and told that they need to be better. What's no surprise that that disconnected eating comes from something like that.
And the sad thing is that this is what's quote unquote normal, right? I feel like this is part of that sport culture that, I mean, it happens so often, but people think they may not, like you were talking about earlier, they may not resonate or identify with having disordered eating tendencies. Like, oh, that's just how I eat, or that's what I'm supposed to do, or that's what my teammates are doing, or my coach told me to do.
And I think when we don't resonate with the worst behaviors, we can normalize what we're doing. And I guess there's a trigger warning to describe a behavior, but I was on a camp of junior elite athletes, and I remember this one young girl, and the whole time we were away, you know, we were running a heap of kilometers every week, and she would only eat beans every single meal. And I just remember thinking, oh, that's an eating disorder. But that's actually a really, really high-end severe eating disorder. And I just remember thinking, like, comparing what I was doing to her and thinking, well, mine's not an eating disorder because I'm eating more than beans. And I think in our distance community, when there are some really, I guess, severe cases of eating disorders that are normalized, it's very easy to not identify with, you know, those more subtle ways of doing it.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. It's so interesting how you don't think like, oh, I don't have an eating disorder, I'm not just eating beans. Like that just seems so systemic in the running world.
Yeah. I'm curious, Georgie, what are the perceptions of the people in your study? I mean, is there shame associated with disordered eating in sport, or are most people in denial, kind of like you said, or maybe they not even in denial, they just don't have that awareness, so they're not drawing those connections?
Yeah, so I've been doing some qualitative interviews with male distance runners and male lightweight rowers, and it's been so interesting to ask about. I've been asking, like, you know, what is disordered eating, what does it look like, and more often than not they can't describe it. But then when we get into the interviews and they describe their own behaviours, to me, lots of those things stand out as disordered eating. And then when they come around full circle and we, you know, explore the concept again, they go, oh, well, that's a woman's issue. Or, you know, that's something that if a man had it, it would be really shameful to do. And I think it's a very gendered, in male athletes, it's very gendered to think that it's just something that affects women. But also that shame is so powerful there, that if it's seen as this bad, naughty, shameful thing to do, it's really going to reduce the chance that athletes talk about it, because they're going to be fearful that they're going to be seen as, you know, less masculine, or they're going to be seen as like a failure as a runner or whatnot. And it's just not the case at all. And I think, again, coming back to Mary Kane, it's just so awesome to see people like that, and Lauren Fleshman, et cetera, all these wonderful women coming forward, because when we can shine a light onto these behaviours, that is when we start to unpack it, and that is when the shame starts to go away, when that light is shown onto the shame.
Yeah, I totally agree in that the shame becomes the identity. And like you said, that will prevent talking about it. I probably should have asked this earlier, but can we just take a step back and maybe have you share some examples of disordered eating? Or I know you have a post about kind of diet culture and sport, but just so our listeners kind of understand what we're talking about, that maybe it may seem normal, but whether it's a food rule or something else that you've come across in your research.
Yeah, cool. Okay. So disordered eating, I guess I want to separate. Disordered eating is the umbrella term. And then under that, we've got our cognitions, so our thoughts, and then we've got our behaviors. So often I think people, when they hear disordered eating, they think it's just behaviors and very obvious ones. So it can be. It can be, you know, restricting carbohydrates on a plate because that's what we think we should be doing. Or it could be stopping eating a meal despite not feeling satisfied. It might be going long periods of time, so say like over 4 hours without eating. It might be actively not having a snack after we go for a long run to try and control our bodies. It might be, you know, doing really, really long runs and not fueling on that. It might be not having a snack before we go on a long run. The behavior can look any number of ways. And I think this is where my research is trying to expand what we think of it. So always it's been around just restricting. So restricting these things. But I think where the key to disordered eating is actually the thoughts that we marry up to these behaviors. So you might be someone that you look at their plate and it doesn't look like they have a lot of carbohydrates on there. And the thoughts going through your head might be not thinking about food at all. And to me, I would be thinking, well, I don't think that's disordered eating because there isn't the thoughts married to the behaviors. Whereas we might be, you know, we might skip a snack that day and be really hungry and our thoughts are going, eat the snack, don't eat the snack, eat the snack. That's disordered eating because there's the thoughts that are going through our mind. So disordered eating is a really hard thing to define or give examples to because so much of it is actually what's going on in our head. It's not necessarily what we're doing in our behaviors. And then, so when we do these things over time, or those thoughts are there over time, that's when we have that really high risk of developing an eating disorder. So does that make sense around disordered eating?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Those are things we bring up all the time on the podcast and in our own social media content. All of those examples I've used with clients and just in general, 100%.
Mm. Yeah, great explanation. Mm-hmm. I really, really like how you focused on the cognition part too, because I tell people, if you are hyper-focusing on food, like, something there is not right. Something's not connecting. You're obsessing about food for a reason. And maybe the thoughts, oftentimes I find the thoughts lead to the behavior. So maybe someone's feeling guilty about something they ate. Mm-hmm. So the next behavior is to restrict mm-hmm. or add 20 minutes onto my run because I shouldn't have eaten that. But the thought that surfaced in the first place shows that there is that distrust with your body.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. And I think as well, like, because eating disorders have always been grounded in low-weight anorexia, nervosa, we don't have a good handle around how disordered eating looks with other constructs. So, you know, whether it's binge eating disorder, you know, actually pushing past that feeling of satisfaction and eating more, you know, that's disordered eating too. And I think often that gets really normalized, you know, post-season. And I remember finishing, you know, nationals year after year after year and having this week where I would just binge out on food. And I never would have associated that with that disconnected or disordered eating. And I can now look back on that and say that was because I was restricting so much in the lead up to those big races that the aftermath was that binge. And I think often people just normalize, you know, those kind of things so much, that restrict binge cycle across the season. There's orthorexia nervosa as well, which yeah, can have a really big, I guess, like association for people too, which is often so unknown.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Have you done any like recent research about how waking or improving your dietary patterns can improve performance? We talk about this all the time in podcast episodes and with our own clients, how eating enough, gaining weight, fueling those long runs, like you mentioned, before and after, all of that. Like, have you seen any improvement in performance in that regard?
So what I'm doing at the moment is I'm just finishing collecting data to develop a tool, which will show, it'll show where people sit on this spectrum of eating behaviors, whether they're at that eating disorder risk, disordered eating, or they have a positive relationship with food. And it's also going to show it's going to have a score that breaks down into behaviors and cognitions. And then the plan for that when I finish my PhD is then to relate that to more the physiological side of things. So we've got some super great research coming out of relative energy deficiency in sport, REDS, and female athlete triad, or just the triad now, looking at those things. And if we can sort of marry these things and use my tool, we'll be able to see, you know, what body composition does if people, you know, if people do gain weight and their score comes down and there's performance benefits or physiological benefits. That'll be really cool to see, because at the moment we actually don't have good data that marry those concepts together. So a lot of the weight gain stuff comes out of the red space, but it's not coming out of the disordered eating disorder space in sport. It's kind of like once female athlete triad became really established in 2007, and then you've got REDS coming about in 2014. Everyone got obsessed with these concepts in sport, and disordered eating kind of got forgotten about. So I'm trying to put those things back on the agenda as well, and then we can do more of that physiological research too. But I think the weight gain side of things is really, really, really interesting, because disordered eating, one of the biggest indications there is really the thoughts that we have around our body. So if we're eating a certain way and we're working with a dietitian who suggests we eat more, and there's a fear behind that because we don't want our bodies to change, that's often a really good indication that we might have an eating disorder or we are going through disordered eating. So I think the weight gain thing is really, is fascinating. And I think in some of the cultural studies that I've been doing in sport, like body change is just this belief of being bad and just something you don't want. And I'd love to see that really change in the culture of sport, just to normalize body change no matter what it's for. You know, whether you're injured or you're going through COVID lockdown and your body changes, for that to be like A-okay. Or even just, I think, you know, talking with some elite distance runners and them saying, you know, I have a friend who said when she did her PB at an international meet, she was her heaviest. And I just don't think we get that narrative enough, because it contradicts this diet culture belief that exists in sport.
And PB is personal best, in case anyone doesn't know. Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes. I think to clarify as well, we call track and field athletics, which is so confusing.
I am really interested to see more research on that, Georgie. I think it's fascinating that you are taking this on and have this interest, because this is going to be useful and helpful for so many people. You might not have data on this yet, or I'm not quite sure if it's part of your exact study, but I'm curious in terms of current versus former athletes. I think I can make the argument for both sides. Have you found any differences in disordered thought or eating patterns among one or another? Whereas maybe a current athlete is in the thick of it, right? Their pressure to compete and perform and look a certain way is right there. But maybe as a former athlete, you've lost your identity. You're kind of trying to figure out who you are now. And I'm sure there's still some pressure associated with that as well.
I love this as a question. and you're going to get me on my soapbox, right? So at the start of my PhD, I started thinking about former athletes because I was going through that experience myself. And I was like, but what about the former athletes? And started looking through some of the research. And I was like, where is this research? And it doesn't exist. So I wrote a systematic lit review on it. And there are 16 studies total in the whole world ever in history that look at vaguely, and I say vaguely, like disordered eating and body image in former athletes. There are 2 papers in the whole world that have actually measured disordered eating, and the quality of the studies is okay, but they're very specific or small groups of people. And I think one of them showed that eating disorders exist in 0.5 of this population that they studied, which were former weight class male athletes. And another one was around, it was like 5% or something really small. And I was like, I think something else is up here. So as soon as I wrote this paper, I got really passionate about former athletes because I was like, I just know in my body this is not the case. And just seeing so many of our former Olympians kind of allude to this topic, but not really have the language or not really have the support around it, and just sort of watching them really struggle with their body change, I just knew something was going to be here. And so since then, we've just recruited over 900 current and former athletes for this study that I'm doing at the moment, with about half of those being former athletes. And the preliminary evidence is showing that disordered eating disorder rate is exactly the same as it is in current athletes, which really just changes sort of everything that we've thought about former athletes. Like, that focus has been on current athletes so much, where we've got all these papers saying, you know, athletes have 2-3 up to 5 times the rates of eating disorders than the general population. And then yet, if we're looking at former athletes having exactly the same, we're doing so little about former athletes. Like, we're not doing enough about current, but former athletes, we're doing nothing. And I think in so many ways, like, current athletes, especially our top elite athletes, they have so much support in terms of, you know, their treatment teams, and I guess we have physios, which is like physical therapists in America, and you know, they'll see them every couple of days, and they'll get massages and have their dietitians and doctors and physiologists and all these people around them. And then who do the former athletes have? Just, you know, their family and friends. And I really feel for the former athletes as well, because they're, right, you know, so much of their life they've been treated like these athletic robots. And then their humanness comes crashing down all at once, and they're dealing with what should be really normalized body change. They're going through those identity changes. You know, they're looking at themselves in the mirror, trying to see that, you know, that former distance runner, and their body is changing. And that, I really empathize with that, you know, going through it myself and having my own body change a lot since I was a distance runner. And just knowing that there's all these former athletes out there, and there's just such little support or resources to support them.
Yeah, for sure. That's so interesting, because you always just kind of forget about former athletes and think that they're going to be okay and they're going to go on their way and everything is fine. So that's interesting that you're looking at both, for sure.
Mm. Yeah, I think I'm not exactly sure how it is in America, but often I find with our former male athletes as well, there is so much body shaming that goes on in the sports media around them. So a lot of our Australian rules football players will come back and do commentating or whatnot. And often there's just these really kind of surface, really superficial humor around their body changes, and everyone laughs and it's so normalized, but we actually don't really know what that experience is like for that person. And I really empathize with the former athletes, because often as soon as they're in the media again, the body commentary is what comes up for them first. And if they're struggling, that just, you know, breaks my heart seeing that just so normalized.
You have a recent Instagram post where you list out what diet culture looks and sounds like in sport. And it definitely seemed like a hot button topic based off of the comments that you got. So can you talk about that with us and maybe review some of those examples?
Yes, I'd love to do that. So I want to clarify what diet culture is, because diet culture has become a phrase that influencers have adopted, or your former Weight Watchers kind of places. They've really latched onto this buzzword. And so I'm seeing a lot of influencers say diet culture is bad, and their followers kind of regurgitate this but not actually know what it means. And so diet culture is a belief system that focuses specifically on size, on shape, on people's weight, on BMI. And it's a system that values predominantly thinness, and in particular, thin white bodies, which is a really interesting history. And there's a book called Fearing the Black Body by Sabrina Strings, which actually goes into the history of why we value thinness and why we value weight. And it's inherently, I guess, got racist upbringings there. And so diet culture focuses on this, you know, this thin body, and it focuses on how we look. And so when I posted this post, I forgot that I didn't quite do the, I guess, like, you know, sometimes in Instagram, you've got to do this big explanation to get this like nuanced point across. And I did this post where I was like, what diet culture sounds like in sport. And I had these little points. And over the next few days, I got all this, I guess, like, there was a lot of confusion around the lay person in seeing the things here and challenging what I'd written. And I think that is so great, because it means that there's a discomfort there. And that is the whole aim of my Instagram, is to challenge people's beliefs. If we go full circle around to what I was, you know, the messages that I was taking in as an adolescent, and just taking in these beliefs that puberty was bad and weight gain was bad and all of these things, I wish that I had someone to just kind of shake things up a little bit at that time. And that is the point of my Instagram posts. They're not meant to be clappy hands emoji kind of responses all the time. They're meant to feel a little bit uncomfortable. And so in this post, I think a lot of the nuance and unpacking it really got lost. And so something like I used race weight as an example of diet culture, and people really didn't like that. So race weight, I guess, is often thrown around in a distance running community as, you know, having a set number of kilograms or pounds that we race best at. And I think this really disrupted people's beliefs, because, again, if we come back to what diet culture is, it's a belief system that focuses on weight over well-being. So if we're focusing on a specific number and we get really caught up in that is the weight we need to be at to perform, that's when we start to do everything in our power to control that weight. For example, if our race weight is 60 kilos or something, or 125 pounds, and we think, yes, that is what I need to be, that is what I need to be, and we're coming up to a big race and we're not that, what are we going to do? We're going to restrict our food. We're going to deplete our glycogen stores in our muscles. We're not going to have the right protein and carbohydrates to recover from our sessions. And ultimately what we're going to do is we're going to put our body under more stress. So that is why it's diet culture. And I think a lot of people aren't ready to hear how diet culture really looks like in sport, because it actually challenges everything. It challenges all of these beliefs we've had for decades and decades. And I think with any cultural challenge, it's not fun. You go on a journey and you ultimately come out of it in a better way. But it's not a pleasant thing to experience acutely. Long term, absolutely. And then I think another one on this post was, quote, "You're looking fit." And I hear that all the time in sport, where people look at an athlete and say that. And there are so many fitness components, all of them, that do not have a fitness, like a way, a look, an appearance. And so, you know, you can't tell if someone is fit by looking at them. And so those kind of comments are so normalized in sport. And when we say you're looking fit, we actually mean you're looking thin, you're looking small, you're looking, you know, whatever it is that comes back to diet culture, where we're focusing on that weight, shape, size over the actual doing. Does that make sense?
Totally. Totally. And another way I like to kind of explain it to people is the way I see diet culture is it's a focus that we all should be treated the same, right? So it completely takes out the autonomy or individual preferences of a person. So looking at your post, I'm seeing cutting out carbs makes me perform better. So who told you that? Is that something you read online? Did it come from an influencer? Where's the science behind that? Carbs are the number one source of energy for endurance athletes. I'm not eating insert food here until nationals. So is this food rule, is this based on something that worked for someone else? Is it based on what someone told you? Is it based on a good or bad food that's designated by diet culture? Copying what someone eats because of their body size. So again, all of these are taking you out of your own body and taking you away from making your own choices, because you're almost tracking back to diet culture every time. Like, am I doing this right? This is what diet culture says to do. And so I think your point, Georgie, of you're not here to get all of the heart emojis, but what you're doing is bringing awareness. People might not even realize this is what diet culture is. I mean, we're sparking some conversation here, and yeah, we might step on some toes, but that's because this has become so normalized that we kind of have to take a step back and say, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be. It shouldn't be like this.
Absolutely. And there's another one on there as well that people only being interested in what, quote, thin athletes eat. And I find this fascinating. If you do a Google search on, you know, what blah, blah, blah does, like, eats in a day. And I challenge you to try and find what a thrower eats in a day. And they are the most incredible athletes. And that is diet culture that, you know, no media articles, no, you know, online websites have said, hey, ex-world champion, Olympic, you know, medalist, what do you eat in a day? Because these, that is diet culture, that we're valuing these thin bodies over, you know, what is performance, what is power, what is strength. And I think that's a really interesting one in track and field, where distance runners or sprinters are kind of seen as these, like, pinnacles of, quote, health. And that's actually weight stigma that comes through in that way. And I think we forget that diet culture and weight stigma exist in sport so much.
Well, Georgie, you have given us so much to think about here. Now, as we start to think about wrapping up, I mean, what do you see? What are the biggest changes based on the research you've done so far, your experience as an athlete, what studying athletes, knowing the culture? Where do you think we need to start, or what needs to happen in culture and sport?
The most important thing, I learned this in a first aid course, is when someone is struggling, it's sort of a triage system. And the first person you look out for is always yourself. And I think that when we're trying to change culture, that stands, you know, as the most important message here, is what we can do is, you know, change our beliefs slowly. But the most powerful thing that we can do is actually just check in with ourselves and have that honest conversation with ourselves. So, you know, if that's through journaling, if that's through even talking things out with a friend, or just having those thoughts go through your mind is, well, how am I? Like, what is going on for me? What is this experience of this sporting culture, of this social culture that I'm in? Am I okay? Or is this a little bit hard? You know, am I finding those intrusive thoughts around comparing bodies, around doing more kilometers or miles because, you know, I've eaten something? And I think just being really honest with ourselves is step number one. Step number two is knowing it's not our fault. You know, we live in this diet culture world where it is so hard to push back against. And, you know, we are not wrong. We are not bad. We are not evil for having eating disorders. It is not our fault. That is always going to happen in this culture that we live in. And then I think the third part of that is knowing in a culture that we're a part of, we contribute to that. So once we've checked in with ourselves, we've told ourselves it's not our fault, then what we can do is actually have those conversations, look out for those things, notice diet culture around us, be skeptical, be okay to sit with that discomfort. And, you know, notice when a coach might say to an athlete, you're looking fit, or we need to get you to race weight, or you need to cut back on this. Noticing those, checking in with that athlete to say, are you okay? You know, that was a bit rough. I'd be annoyed if something like that was said to me, and whatever it is, or calling out that coach, having a conversation, or calling out athletes that normalize this culture. Because when we're part of a culture, we have the ability to change it. And I think, you know, there's very public ways that we can do things like that by posting on Instagram or sharing people's posts, but actually having those conversations with the people around us is who we are most likely to have a really big and significant impact with. And the more that we have these conversations, that is how the real cultural change happens. So rather than seeing, yeah, Mary Kane and what happened with her as this, like, really, I guess, extreme and awful situation, is seeing how these things happen in every single culture that we're a part of it and challenging that. So they're my three things.
Love it. That's a practical list for people, and totally talk about it. I mean, it's not something to hide or pretend you're not a part of, because like you said, we are all part of this culture. We can call it out and we can all learn. Maybe a coach is not meaning to be within the diet culture realms by saying we need to get you to race weight. I mean, they grew up in the same culture. So I think education is important too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when someone comments on your body, that is always reflective of what they are going through themselves and the diet culture messages that they are internalizing themselves. So having that compassion for us and compassion for other people, yeah, for living in that diet culture. It's not black and white. It is really nuanced and gray.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I love that, Georgie. Thank you so much for sharing all of this with us and giving us a really deep dive into all of the so needed research that you are doing.
Yeah, we're going to put a link to your survey. Can anyone take your survey?
Yeah, so all current and former athletes, very welcomed. All sports, all countries, and it's identity, so you don't have to have competed at a certain level.
Perfect. Well, any of our former or current athletes right now, we'd love for you to take that survey for Georgie. As you can tell, she is doing some really important research in this field, this niche that is very, very important. So Georgie, we like to round out with some rapid fire questions.
Okay, so don't overthink it. Just answer first thing that comes into your head, okay? What is your favorite ice cream flavor?
Chocmint.
Yummy. That sounds good. What's your favorite type of workout?
I have an 18-month-old dog, so going to get coffee with him is my favorite workout. That's so welcome cool. to being a former athlete.
What kind of dog do you have?
He is a Cavoodle, which I think is called a Cavapoo in the US.
So cute.
He's about, I think, 10 pounds or 12 pounds. Just quite small. Very fluffy.
So cute. What's your favorite easy weeknight meal?
My partner and I are a really big fan of Uber Eats at the moment.
Love it.
So probably like pizza or pasta. high, or yeah. Well, it's kind of scary going to the supermarkets at the moment. So we're doing our bit, you know.
What's your favorite coffee order?
I have a large cappuccino, so that means two shots every morning.
Okay, this is a really important one, Georgie. Tacos or pizza?
Okay.
Or if there's an Australian equivalent.
This is hard because this is really tough. If the pizza has prosciutto on it, then pizza. But if the tacos are done really well with like the soft kind of handmade tacos, then it's tacos. So this is, there's no easy answer for this one.
Two of the best. Good answer. What is your bedtime routine?
I have been reading a lot of books lately, so I'll often read for the last hour or two. I'm also really into Bachelor in Paradise at the moment.
Yes! Wait, there's not a new season, is there?
We've got the Australian.
No, just old.
Which is...
I love that show too. Oh, Australian. I didn't even think that you had an Australian version.
Australian Bachelor and Bachelorette is so different to the American version. Like, so different.
I know. We're going to have to try and watch it. Sarah and I both said that's our guilty pleasure. It's bad. It's a problem.
That's like my favorite. Yeah. Yeah. My no thanks show. Yeah. Bring it on.
Oh, there is no guilt involved in this.
Okay. So I guess you might have answered our last question. Favorite show to binge watch?
Well, it's actually not Bachelor in Paradise, but it's at the moment. So Real Housewives of New York, I've started from scratch, and it is giving me life because every time they go to a restaurant or a location, I'll look it up on Google Maps and just check out the photos and pretend that I'm traveling at the moment.
Oh, man, aren't we all, right? Sheesh. Well, Georgie, thank you so much for coming on and discussing everything with us. We love chatting with you, and we didn't even have that many questions in this hour. Flew by. You're just a wealth of information.
You know, we might have to have you back on once you get results from your research, if you're open to it.
Yes. I'm collecting intuitive eating data, so that'll be really interesting to see how it plays. Yeah, because it hasn't been done before, so...
Oh, we can't wait. Well, we're going to link to your social media, your website, your survey, some of your publishings, so our readers and listeners can learn more about you.
Thanks, Georgie.
Awesome. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for having me.
That wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review so others can find it more easily. You can also stay in touch with us by joining our Facebook group, Nutrition for Runners. If you have any requests for future episode topics and more, email us at nailyournutritioncourse1@gmail.com. Happy fueling!